From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Terry McMillan, the author of Waiting to Exhale, has a new novel about a 42-year-old single mother who falls in love with a man half her age. As we'll hear, McMillan is writing from her own experience. Also, we meet the chef of the acclaimed lemongrass restaurant and cafes in Sacramento, Mai Pham. She has a new cookbook about the cuisines of Vietnam and Thailand, the countries in which she was raised. She came to America in 1975 as Saigon was falling. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the latest CD by Hootie and the Blowfish. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton received Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat at the White House today for a business meeting. UPI's Bill Small prepared this report.
President Clinton began the meeting by praising Yasser Arafat for last week's decision by the Palestine National Council to drop the call for Israel's destruction from its charter. Mr. Clinton saying Arafat had kept his promise.
Now it's time for us to discuss the continuation of the peace process. What we can do to help improve the welfare of the Palestinian people, which I know is uppermost on his mind, and we are very concerned about that.
Mr. Clinton again avoided questions on the U.S. attitude toward creation of an independent Palestinian state, saying again it's a matter for negotiation between Israel and the Palestinian people. Bill Small at the White House.
Divers and dogs have yet to find former CIA Director William Colby. Searchers are still looking in the Wicomico River in southern Maryland. Colby is presumed drowned from a canoeing accident over the weekend. Searchers still aren't giving up hope. One trainer with Search and Rescue Dogs of Maryland says the team of three dogs is nearly 90% effective in locating bodies on land or in water. William Colby ran the CIA between 1973 and 76 under Presidents Nixon and Ford. There may be progress in talks between federal agents and the Montana Freemen. Intermediary Beau Greitz says the group believes some charges against some of the Freemen will be dropped if they surrender soon. But a Montana state negotiator says Greitz seems misinformed. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
Beau Greitz, the flamboyant champion of the Patriot Movement, says the Freemen believe that if they surrender today, some state charges will be dropped against some of the people who've been holed up at a Montana ranch for 5 weeks. Greitz met the Freemen yesterday for the fourth straight day, but John Connor, the state of Montana's official negotiator in the standoff, says Greitz appears to be misinformed about the official talks. Connor has the power to drop state and local charges, which include threatening public officials and advocating violence to achieve political change. Charges are also pending in other states, and there are serious federal charges which federal officials seem unwilling to drop. Despite the deal, whatever it is, Greitz says he doesn't believe the Freemen are about to give up. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
A private research group says the country's future economic activity looks positive. The Conference Board says its index of leading economic indicators rose 0.2% in March. The index is supposed to predict economic activity 6 to 9 months in advance. The measurement was up in February, too. Analysts say a third consecutive monthly increase would mean a trend. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 10 points at 5,578. Trading is heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq has risen 6.5 points to 1,196. This is NPR. The new Chechen separatist leader, rumored to be dead, showed up on rebel television today. Zelim Khan Yandarbayev says he'll continue the battle against Russia to the last soldier. Yandarbayev says the rumors of his death were spread by the pro-Moscow Chechen government. Yandarbayev had just been named to succeed rebel leader Jokhar Dudayev, who the rebels say was killed in a Russian airstrike April 21st. Yandarbayev says he has named his own successor in case he's really killed. He also says Chechen rebels won't talk to Russian negotiators until Russian troops are pulled out of his region. Three U.S. Navy ships are stationed off the coast of Monrovia, Liberia's capital, in an apparent show of force. The display comes a day after U.S. Marines shot and killed three Liberians who were firing toward the U.S. embassy. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Nearly 3,000 U.S. soldiers have been stationed in the U.S. embassy and off the coast for the past 10 days to help evacuate foreign nationals fleeing factional fighting. Five naval ships had been kept about 30 miles offshore, carefully out of sight. The movement of three of the ships toward the coast follows U.S. diplomats' strong condemnation of the latest clashes. Yesterday, fighting surged toward the U.S. embassy for the first time, and Marines returned fire. Today, there are unconfirmed reports that more soldiers are heading into the city. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State George Moose left Monrovia by military helicopter early Wednesday morning after failing to meet Liberia's faction heads. Before leaving, he blamed the current battle on militia leader Charles Taylor, who's renewed his attacks on a downtown military barracks. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Monrovia.
Today is Labor Day in many countries. About 15,000 activists of outlawed labor unions marched in Seoul, South Korea today. Turkish unions protested high inflation, and tens of thousands of Russians participated in May Day rallies steeped in campaigning. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Terry McMillan has a new novel. Her previous novel, Waiting to Exhale, is a tough act to follow. The book sold close to 4 million copies. And the film adaptation, which McMillan co-wrote, was a box office and cultural phenomenon. The story is about four women friends searching mostly in vain for the right man. The main character of McMillan's new novel, How Stella Got Her Groove Back, is a 42-year-old divorced single mother who is on the verge of giving up hope of ever feeling any excitement or passion toward a man until she takes a vacation in Jamaica, a vacation she can easily afford. She's an analyst for one of the world's largest investment banks. On her Jamaican vacation, Stella meets a 21-year-old man named Winston, who makes her feel all those things she never expected to feel again. But being twice his age, she doesn't trust her feelings or his. This is the scene shortly after they meet, and he's made it clear he's attracted to her.
Let me ask you something. What's the oldest woman you've ever been with, Winston? 24. And I say, well, you'd have to turn those numbers around for me, sweetie. And he says, so? And I see he is somber. I mean, there is like this, what is the problem look on his face and in his eyes. And I say, wait a minute, let me get this straight. And he is smiling deeply at me again as if he knows what I'm about to say. And even I don't know what I'm about to say. But he is clearly ready to respond. And I take the first of a series of hyperventilated breaths and force out, are you saying you would like to sleep with me, Winston? And I look at him to see his reaction to that one, and without blinking, he says, absolutely. And he gives me a don't look so surprised look, and out of the corner of my eye, I glimpse the old man watching us. Winston pushes his right hand under the surface of the water, and I can feel his long fingers barely graze my waist. And when I look into his eyes this time, my body quivers and shudders, and I can't believe it when I hear myself say, okay. He is grinning fiercely and blushing at the same time, and he says, really? And I look at him and say, really? You won't change your mind like last night, will you? I don't think so, Winston, but I'll tell you something. I don't know what I'm doing, and I can't believe what I just said to you. I mean, there's something illegal about this, isn't there? He is giving me a very comforting look. There is nothing illegal about this, and I don't understand what would make you say something like that. Winston, I sigh. What? He sighs back, and he truly does look clueless. I'm old enough to be your mother, but you're not my mother. I know that. You don't look like my mother, you don't act like my mother, and you certainly don't feel like my mother, he says. I must admit, he is rather convincing, but this is totally scandalous, Stella, and you know it.
Terry McMillan, what's the inspiration for this novel?
Oh, I went to Jamaica. I'll put it this way. I went to Jamaica last summer, because 2 years prior to that, my mother died unexpectedly at my home when I was in Rome touring for Waiting to Exhale. Then a year to the day later, my best girlfriend, Doris Jean Austin, died. And I hadn't really experienced that kind of loss before, if ever. And I didn't know how long this grieving process lasted. All I knew is that I was not feeling very good, and I wasn't able to write. And so I decided last June to go to just do something ridiculous or something spontaneous. And my sister was going to go to Jamaica in October. And when she was explaining to me where she was going to stay, I said, you know what, I should just do that. And I did it. And when I got there, you know, it was sort of like the first time I'd ever done anything for myself, well, in a long time, with no guilt, and where it wasn't writing-related, where I've traveled. And something really beautiful happened to me there, and I came home, and I started feeling like my old self again, almost before my mom and my best girlfriend had died, because it was I was feeling different. I was sad all the time. Not depressed, but just sad, you know, because I missed them. And I sort of got rejuvenated down there, and I didn't quite understand it. I mean, my boyfriend's name is Jonathan, and he's young. He's not as young as Winston, but he's young. And he's only partially responsible for it. It was almost as if I felt like my mother and Dora sort of visited me on the beach or something and said, look, it's okay, we know you miss us, but you got to get on with your life, honey. And so that's sort of what the inspiration was. It's about healing and about taking risk and giving yourself permission to feel good.
So you felt that somehow you felt the presence of the people who you'd lost with you in Jamaica, and they were giving you permission to continue living and encouraging you to take chances again. Was one of the chances allowing yourself to have a relationship with somebody much younger than you? Did you think of that as a big chance, as a big risk?
No, because when I was in Jamaica, I had no intention or didn't even think about the fact that Jonathan and I would end up ultimately having a relationship. It was just something fun to do. So when I left Jamaica and came home, it wasn't with the thought that I'd ever see him again. It wasn't, not at all. But I was a different person. I just felt, you know, emotionally mobile again when I left Jamaica. And like I said, it was just, you know, exercising, being on the beach, eating good food, reading, you know, not having the phone ring, no fax machines, nobody bugging me for autographs, even though some of the people that worked there did. But it wasn't the same. And I sort of felt removed in a way and yet very, very present. It was sort of like I was able to step outside of my own world and observe it in a way. But I didn't do that again until I got home. That's what sort of inspired the book. It was sort of like, gee whiz, what happened to me down there? You know, because I came back and my sisters all said, Terry, you look different. You know, I mean, I was laughing. Not to say that I hadn't laughed in 2 years, but it was different. And I didn't quite understand it, you know, and I wanted to.
Stella, the main character in your novel, says that the idea of seeing a man in his 20s when she was 42 seemed scandalous to her. Did that idea seem scandalous to you?
Oh, yeah, I didn't take Jonathan seriously at all because it was, well, not scandalous. That's just a term I use. I didn't quite feel like that. I think a little risque. Well, maybe scandalous might be appropriate. I don't know. But, you know, he never saw it that way. Not at all. But, I mean, the bottom line is that I ultimately had to question all of it. And that, too, is what made what was part of the inspiration behind the book. You know, I started thinking, gee whiz, you know, if I was a guy and I was 42 and I was going out with, you know, a woman in her 20s, nobody would think twice about it. It would make a boring book, really. I mean, men do it all the time. All the time. And well, nobody thinks twice about it.
Well, in fact, I mean, men do it all the time, and often women really resent it. Like if a woman in her 40s has seen or is seeing a man who's in his 40s then or 50s, then he leaves for somebody in her 20s. I mean, women kind of resent that, and I wonder if you see it differently now that you're involved with somebody who's in his 20s.
Well, I've never really actually, first of all, I've never been in a position like that, but I wouldn't say, I mean, I think a lot of men go through midlife crises, to be very honest with you, where they're questioning and wondering about their own sexuality, their own masculinity. And I think to some extent, and they want to know that they're still appealing and all that. That's why I think a lot of them go that way. But you rarely will see a poor 40 or 50 year old man with a 20 year old. They almost always have to have money and something else going for them, believe me. And I think the beauty for me here was that Jonathan didn't know who I was. He didn't have a clue. And it was so refreshing. Mm-hmm. God, it was refreshing. That was another thing that, you know, to meet somebody who didn't know who you were. It was nice. I didn't care how old he was, to be honest with you.
Are there preconceptions that you've come up against about why a woman would see a much younger man?
Well, you know, the news is just I mean, I'm just starting to make this public, but, you know, I mean, I don't have much choice. I mean, Jonathan is here. He's not going anywhere, I don't think, anytime soon. And everybody knows I've written a book. He's Jamaican. Yes, yes, yes. I don't know. I really don't care, you know, to be honest with you. They're going to say what they want to say, but I don't think I've been this happy in centuries.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad.
So I'm not advocating younger men, but all I can say is this one's working for me.
Terry, there's a scene I'd like you to read from the beginning of your new novel, How Stella Got Her Groove Back. This is early on, before all the changes in her life have happened, and she's thinking about all the phone messages she gets, and this is the section about those phone messages.
I know I'm not alone because I'm forever getting messages from estranged friends and relatives who are pissed because I haven't returned their phone calls for whenever. And they say things like, girl, I could be dead and you wouldn't know it. What kind of friend are you, Stella? We used to be close. Did I do something that I don't know about? And I shake my head no. Or they say, we just had a baby, or I finally got my divorce and I just wanted you to know that I don't live in Atlanta or Memphis or Los Angeles anymore. And oh, by the way, I got a brand new grandbaby. And did you get the pictures? If you didn't, you didn't say nothing about how cute he is. And hell, he got three teeth now. Or he walking, or he's in kindergarten. And this is the MCI operator with a collect call from Benny. Please press 1 if you accept and 2 if you decline. And sir, the party's not at home. And he says, okay, but can I leave a message anyway? And then there's a click, and he is just one of my many relatives who call from the penitentiary. But then there's like, hey, yeah, Stella. This is your cousin Rafiki. Assalamu alaikum, my sister. Peace be unto you. All praises are due to Allah. And hey, I know you surprised I ain't calling collect, but my lady let me use her calling card for a month, and you still ain't send me no pictures of you. And I'm still working on my own defense, and I was wondering if you could send me $50 for some toiletries and such, because my mom ain't been up to see me in over 6 months. She mad at me, and my lady ain't got no more transport to get way out here, and I've been in the hole for the past month or something, for I ain't even dead. But it's all good. And anyway, let me know if you can do that. And baby, this is your Aunt Junie calling, and I don't know if you know it or not, but Miss Willa May in the hospital, and I know you remember her because she used to babysit you when you was a baby, and you know she got cataracts, and she had to have that operation finally that she been putting out because of having all them insurance problems and everything, but you remember her? She Miss Bessie's cousin, sister of what married her first cousin, Silver, what used to live around the corner of Moke and 40th Street, right down the street from Miss Lucy when she was living. Anyway, you went to school with her granddaughter, but I can't remember her name right now, but pray for her. Even though she do a much better now. And I just want to touch base. Don't get to talk to you much no more. And how is Quincy these days? I bet he's tall as you. And how old is he now? There is a long pause because she is waiting for an answer. And like a fool, I say, he's 11 and a half, Aunt Junie. But even though you don't stay in touch, girl, I want you to know that you both are all in my prayers. And the Lord is watching over you. And I'm going to call your sisters as soon as I hang up since the rates is low. Love you, baby. I wonder if her machine is going to get all this. Stella, did you get this whole mess of sugar?
That's a great scene.
Thank you.
Is that a lot like your answering machine?
Not quite. I don't really have any aunts that call me like that. But when I was little, I had aunts like that that I remembered.
That's Terry McMillan. She's the author of the new book, How Stella Got Her Groove Back. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Terry McMillan. Her new novel, How Stella Got Her Groove Back, is her first book since the very popular Waiting to Exhale. At the beginning of the novel, before Stella goes to Jamaica, she's, you know, thinking about relationships and being single for a long time. And she says she's basically given up on marriage. She says, marriage wears you out, and I'm not sure if I have the energy left for it. All my married friends are mostly miserable. They're just in it because they started it, those kids. I've pretty much come to the conclusion that marriage itself is a dead-end institution. Is that your conclusion, too?
Sometimes. I mean, I've never been married. And I think because my mom was married 5 times, and I never really thought about it before, but I mean, I've been proposed to 6 times, and each time I said no, because I knew it wasn't going to last. And I think I was just really scared. And plus, they probably wouldn't have lasted. I don't know. I know some people that are happy, but I know more that aren't.
You've been criticized for making most of the men in Waiting to Exhale unlikable. And I'm wondering if you ever thought that it made the women seem foolish for choosing them in the first place.
That was the whole point.
Uh-huh.
That was the point. It wasn't to make the men look bad. It was to make the women realize that, gee whiz, look at what you've chosen. So, you know, don't blame the men. Look at yourselves. That's the whole. A lot of people miss that whole point. All they think about, I mean, the men are like, oh, why are you always male bashing and dogging us out? You know, I chose 5 men deliberately that you shouldn't be thinking about bringing home to mama. I mean, it was deliberate. That's why the movie was called Waiting to Exhale. None of these men were worth exhaling over. Well, a couple of them, you know. And, of course, nobody pays any attention to them. But it was more about, you know, women who choose men. You know, you choose somebody who belongs to somebody else, somebody else's husband you fall in love with. Well, what do you think he's going to do? How many of them actually leave their wives? Very few of them. You know, you choose somebody who you... Plus, I made Robin's, one of the guys Robin goes out with, a drug addict, because women are always thinking they're saviors. They think our love and what we do have between our legs is going to solve everybody's problem. Men, that we can save them. We can rehabilitate them. And we can't. You know, so that was the point. Those were the issues I was trying to deal with, not the fact that all men are dogs, because they aren't. Everybody knows that. Stupid people even should know that.
Did you get surprised reactions for having a male co-writer for the screenplay and a male director?
And a Jewish one at that, huh? Yeah, not really. I mean, if people have said anything, they've sort of kept it to themselves. I think more Forrest than anything. People ask me, you know, like, why'd you choose this white writer? You know? And I said, because he was good at what he did. You know, and Ron Bass is really smart. I mean, he's real intuitive in terms of understanding human emotion, and there's no color on that. And he's proven it before in things that he's written. From Joy Luck Club, he's been Chinese, you know. he's been a savant or whatever, with Rain Man, etc. And he's just really smart. And I have a lot of respect for Ron, and I couldn't have written a screenplay without him, to be honest with you. He's going to help me write Stella, too.
For the movie.
Yeah, if there's going to be a movie, yeah, I guess. He basically does the structuring. That's what he's good at. He knows how to take a book and structure it so that it works as a film. I don't know how to do that. I mean, I read a book about it, but let me tell you, honey, I got migraines. He knows how to do that. But people gave me flack about Forrest. But my attitude was, you know, I thought it was kind of a nice twist, to be honest with you, that they thought I was dogging out a man and we got one to direct. But Forrest did the same thing. He understood what these women's problems were. He even said, you know, their problem is they have a very low sense of self-worth. You know, they don't even, they don't value themselves enough, and that's why they're choosing these creeps for boyfriends. And I was like, hallelujah, you know?
The success of the novel and of the film Waiting to Exhale was almost like a phenomenon, all the people going to see Exhale a second time, a third time, going in groups. What does the success of Waiting to Exhale say to you, aside from the fact that people obviously like your writing and your stories, but what does it say to you about what people want now?
I think what gap
it was filling?
I think people in general, and Black people in particular, just want to be properly or accurately portrayed. I think that we are always rendered in such a way that we are always downtrodden, that, you know, everybody's a crackhead or a gangbanger, you know, that we are always victimized, you know, and everything is tragic, you know. And in most Black communities, there's not a whole lot of tragedy at all times, you know. Even in the projects, you know, people don't get killed walking home. I know people who lived in the projects for 20 years and they're still alive and kicking. Friends, family, everybody lives there, sit out on the bench, drink a beer, you know. There are other aspects of our lives that I think have gone unrecognized. I think also, you know, people don't understand that you can write with humor and still be serious. Ring Lardner did it. J.D. Salinger does it. A lot of people do it. Satirists, in some cases, do it. And I think that's how I see my work. That's how I saw the film. And I've been sort of criticized because, you know, I guess it wasn't this statement that I was making about the affairs or the status of African-American women and men. And I think to some extent, not to say that we shouldn't take a lot of the issues to heart nowadays that are affecting us all, but at the same time, we also have to know when to lighten up and relax and enjoy ourselves and still take what our lives seriously and the political ramifications of everything that's happening around us and how it affects our lives. But you have to know how to separate them. I think that's what the 90s are about for me.
Was it hard for you to write your new book because Exhale has been such a huge success? You know, how can you possibly follow that up? The expectations are so high.
Well, first of all, I was writing a different book, and it was called A Day Late and a Dollar Short that I had written like 140 pages a couple years ago. And then when my mom died, I just went zip. I just didn't have anything in me. I just didn't. And that was another reason why when I went to Jamaica, I mean, I wasn't thinking about, gee whiz, how am I going to follow up Waiting to Exhale? Because first of all, there's always a backlash to when you have a success like this. First the book, and then when the movie hit, I was like, oh, wow, they're going to destroy me. But fortunately, I had already written Stella. I mean, when I got back from Jamaica, like I said, I first of all, I'd quit smoking, and I never thought I'd be able to write without a cigarette. Well, I wrote Stella in a month, the first draft of it, and I just started writing, and I couldn't believe that I was writing, and I was, like, so happy that, you know, I was writing again. And I was, like, thanking my mother, thanking God, thanking Jonathan, everybody, whoever helped me, quote-unquote, get my groove back. I don't know where it came from. I don't really care, to be honest with you, but I just said thank you.
Are you going to go back to the novel you were working on before you
definitely.
Wrote Stella?
Yep, I'm stronger emotionally now, and it's like I have accepted the fact that my mother is gone, that my best girlfriend is gone, that I'm not going to see them again, that they are okay, and that I'm okay. And it has taken me a long time to even be able to say that. So, yeah, I can go back and do it now.
Terry McMillan, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Terry McMillan's new novel is called How Stella Got Her Groove Back. She co-wrote the screen adaptation of her novel Waiting to Exhale. It just came out on video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I shall sing your song.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Chef Mai Pham. Her new book is about the cooking of Vietnam and Thailand, the countries in which she was raised. Her father was in the South Vietnamese military, and the family fled to America as Saigon fell. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Fairweather Johnson, the new CD by Hootie and the Blowfish. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Food was at the center of my mom's life when she was growing up. Now she's the owner and chef of the Lemongrass Restaurant and Cafes in Sacramento, serving Vietnamese and Thai cooking. And she has a new book called The Best of Vietnamese and Thai Cooking. My mom was born in Vietnam and spent 10 years in Thailand, while her father, a high-ranking military officer, served as South Vietnam's military attaché to Thailand. In Thailand, she attended English-speaking schools. Later, as a teenager in Saigon, she hosted a radio show for American GIs and did freelance work for ABC News. 4 days before the fall of Saigon, in April of 1975, she fled Saigon. She was 19. She and her family relocated to Washington, D.C. I asked Mai Pham to describe her memories of leaving Saigon.
We left on a U.S. C-141 plane. It was really chaotic, I would say. And it, looking back, it was very dramatic and very traumatic. I didn't feel anything then really in particular because we were in shock. I remember that the day that we left, when we went, you know, when we went to the airport, that my mother, my brother, and myself, that we were ushered, you know, through this long lines. We waited, I think, at least 3 hours to get aboard the plane. And then when we did get on the plane, I think we sat in the plane for another 2 hours. And I remember during the entire ordeal, which I believe took about 13 to 14 hours to get to Guam, that no one said a word. My mother didn't say anything. I remember that I didn't say anything. And I remember that my brother didn't say anything. And also our uncle was with us too and his family, and no one said anything. And this was very, in looking back, in retrospect, it was rather strange. But I believe we were all in shock and so uncertain as to what the future would hold, and was really, we were all really afraid of what was going to happen to us.
Were you expecting that this dislocation was a temporary or a permanent experience?
We expected this to be very temporary. In fact, I was told by my father, who never really believed in the fall of Vietnam, and sometimes I think that is a little strange, but then again, it's really not, because, you know, being so close to the government, and he worked in the, you know, presidential palace, and being, you know, high up in the government, He never believed that we would lose the war, that we would have to leave our homes and be gone forever, that the country that was backing us, the U.S., the biggest and the most powerful country in the world, would let us down or would lose the war. How could the U.S., the most powerful country in the world, lose the war to the bicycle-riding Viet Congs? It was, you know, a very crazy idea at the moment. And so my father never really believed it. And in fact, you know, he didn't believe it, so he stayed behind. Wow. And he sent my mother and my brother and myself first, thinking that we would go to Guam on a temporary basis just to be on the island there for a few days, and things will re-stabilize, quote unquote, and we would all be back and live, you know, our normal lives. And of course, that didn't happen. And so it's very difficult. Even to this day, he has not returned to Vietnam. And it's something that I have to do for him. I'm going to go back this year. And hopefully, I'm sure I can go back and tell him, it's okay, Dad, to go back.
Did he have trouble getting out?
He had some trouble getting out, but he, again, because he was a high-ranking official, was finally at the end airlifted out of the U.S. Embassy. You might recall the sight, the picture that you see of the helicopter hovering on the rooftop of the U.S. Embassy. Well, he was one of those people that got out that way.
So your family moved, I think, to Washington, D.C.
Right.
Your father had been used to working in the presidential palace in Vietnam. What did he do in America, and what did you do in America?
When we first came, we had sponsors in the Washington area, and at that time, he was promised a job at the Pentagon. Again, being a, you know, high-ranking official, there was this promise that, you know, he would be taken care of, and he would have, you know, a job at the Pentagon. Well, that didn't last very long because there was no interest in Vietnam right after the fall of Vietnam. Everyone wanted to hush up about, you know, what had happened and try to forget. And so he was really left on the street, you know, so to speak. We were staying with some sponsors who were very great, you know, very gracious to take us in. My father went to some, you know, retraining schools in the Washington area. But of course, life, you know, from then on was very different. He took on a job as driving an ice cream truck, and that didn't work out too well because Asians don't really like to drive very much. And later on, after, you know, a few months, he found a job, you know, in the Washington area.
You run a restaurant now that specializes in Vietnamese and Thai cooking. Food is very much at the center of your life, personally and professionally. When you came to the United States from Vietnam, what did you eat, and what did you miss, and how did that affect your life? I mean, was food really important, and was the absence of the food you were used to something that affected you?
The first thing a refugee misses besides family is the food, and yes, we miss the food, and even to this day there are dishes that we still miss.
What did you eat when you got to the United States?
Well, we ate American food when we first came, but my mother was with us, and she would still make rice every day, make catfish in clay pot that I mentioned in the book, the fisherman soup, which is fairly easy to make. That's one thing nice about Vietnamese ingredients, though, or Vietnamese cooking, is that the ingredients are fairly simple to get, except for a few instances. And so my mother still would make us, you know, even though they were very simple dishes of a small dish of meat and a bowl of soup, it was still, you know, very Vietnamese in nature and kind of for a moment took us back home.
Now at your restaurant, at Lemongrass Restaurant in Sacramento, do you have some people who are Vietnamese emigres and others who are Americans? Do you have a combination?
Yes, we do.
And what's the difference between what the Vietnamese clientele wants to eat and what the Americans want to eat?
Well, we serve mostly, because of the area that we are in, mostly American clientele. Really, there were not a whole lot of differences because we serve, I would say, some of the star or the most popular dishes of both cuisines. And the kind of cooking that I do, really, if you ask me, and, you know, one cannot tend to please really all clienteles. I wanted to introduce, impress, and make converts out of our, you know, American clientele. And I think that in the 8 years that we've been in business that we have done that.
Have you changed your dinners in order to suit an American palate?
Only in the beginning, but really to a really small extent, because my cooking really, I sort of have a very open mind about Vietnamese cooking. I like to cook the way I like to eat, and that might be a very personal thing. Mm-hmm. But I, in doing the restaurant, because I did not go into the restaurant business because I had to. I didn't go into it for money. I did it because I have another calling. I wanted to introduce the public to another culture. I wanted to use food as the medium for doing that. I wanted to use food as a way to soften, you know, the story of Vietnam and to get people to become more involved in a culture. And so I decided, since I'm doing it for other than business, then, you know, why can't I do it, you know, really the way I like to do it, which is just to do it the natural way. And so I do a few things that are different, that are not really too traditional, even though that I believe that all of the flavors are quite traditional. Like, I use very traditional herbs and spices. I might change a few ingredients because perhaps the organic pharma has something really interesting that normally we might not have in the Vietnamese repertoire, but that I find it interesting and I would use that. And so I think that's what makes our food especially appealing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mai Pham, and she owns the Lemongrass Restaurant in Sacramento. She has a new cookbook called The Best of Vietnamese and Thai Cooking. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Maya Pham. She's the owner and chef of the Lemongrass Restaurant in Sacramento and the author of the cookbook, The Best of Vietnamese and Thai Cooking. I think most Americans have eaten Chinese food, but not necessarily Vietnamese food. What are some of the basic differences between the two styles of cooking?
First of all, I think they're also similar, so it's not too different. There, you know, lots of use of rice, rice noodles. We do a lot of stir fries also, but Vietnamese dishes are also very different from Chinese. Even though, again, and you know, I mentioned that they share similar techniques and ingredients, but Vietnamese cuisine, I would describe it as being very herbaceous, very refreshing, very light. A classic example of Vietnamese cuisine would probably be a dish in my book, The Best of Vietnamese and Thai Cooking. It's called rice paper wrapped salad rolls, and I don't know if you've had it before, Terry, but it's basically little pieces of poached shrimp or poached pork or really anything that you want, and it's wrapped in edible rice paper. And inside it's lined with fresh lettuce, bean sprouts, rice noodles, and mint. And it's wrapped real tightly and dipped in a black bean peanut sauce or a hoisin peanut sauce. And it's really delightful. So in the Vietnamese repertoire, we eat lots of dishes like that in which we wrap fresh things, small pieces of meat that has been poached, and dip it in a sauce.
You know, when Americans go to Asian restaurants, they often order for the table. Everybody shares, right? So you order, I don't know, three or four different main dishes and put it in the middle of the table, and everybody has a little bit of everything. Is this at all a part of Vietnamese eating style at home, where you'd have actually several dishes?
Very much. Actually, that is the Vietnamese way, is really the Asian way. And that's a sort of a thought or an idea, a concept behind the book that I feel very strongly about. And that is, one, in looking back at how I grew up and thinking about some of the memories that have to do with food, they always come back to, you know, the dinner table.
Mm-hmm.
And the dinner table really was the center of universe. It was the center of family. It was where, you know, we talked about, you know, everything, where friendships were made, family ties were strengthened. We talked, you know, for hours on end, all at the dinner table. And so the dishes that we tend to have also take quite some time to enjoy. The dish that I mentioned to you, the rice paper wrapped salad rolls, a lot of times we would eat that dish and make that dish as we're eating. And so it's not a pre-made, you know, item. And so when you have all sort of activities, things that have to do with, you know, eating from the hands, it becomes a very casual event. And the dinner table was really the meeting place. It's where people came together.
Do you ever feel like the Vietnam War is being refought in your restaurant? Do people come in and ever want to talk with you about American political or military policy in Vietnam? And was the war justified or not justified?
In the beginning years, I think so. And I think that in the beginning years, we weren't very popular because of that very same aspect. There were some people who still had some negative thoughts, or when the word Vietnam came up, it was, you know, it was not a very comfortable idea or a memory. I think that is beginning to change. I know that it has changed, because I can tell from the clientele, the questions. It used to be that we have a lot of people come in and want to tell me about the war stories, or it would be a veteran telling me about a veteran story, which you know, I always listen to and have a, you know, soft spot in my heart for people who have been in our country. But I think that the climate is much better now. I think it's more on a culinary level right now. People are wanting this because it tastes good in the mouth, it feels good, it's fresh, and it's really interesting. And beyond that, it's quite simple to prepare a Vietnamese cuisine.
You're planning on returning to Vietnam soon for the first time since you left in 1975, just a few days before the fall of Saigon. What do you hope to do when you get there?
I hope to go and see my grandmother, who I think, in my soul, I believe, is waiting to see one of us, all of us. When we left, we actually were supposed to go back well, not we, but we had some people from the American Embassy who had promised us that they would return the following day to escort a second group of our family members out of Vietnam. And of course, the military situation got really bad and took a very dramatic turn, and everybody left before they could before they could escort our family members out. And my grandmother was one of them. And, you know, it's been more than 20 years, and she's 95 years old, and she's still there. And we talk to her by phone sometimes, so in my heart, I think that she's waiting for us to come back and see her. And so the important part of going back to Vietnam is to see my grandmother and just to reconnect again with my roots for the first time. And I feel that even though 20 years is a long time to most people, but to many Vietnamese refugees, such as myself, 20 years really is not a long time.
Are there food things you want to do when you go there?
Yes, I'm very interested in going back this time, you know, with the experience that I have as a chef and as a restaurateur, and also as someone who's very curious to see what the future has in hold for Vietnamese cuisine, either in Vietnam or outside of Vietnam, and maybe a role that I could play to try to, you know, promote it and to learn from it and to perhaps use it in the same vein that I have used it, and that is to introduce our culture to, you know, to others through food. And so it'd be interesting to go back to see how food has evolved after the fall of Vietnam.
You know what I'm wondering? In so many American families, the family was split about the war. Maybe the parents supported it and the children didn't, or one brother was in the army and one brother opposed the war. I'm wondering if there was anything comparable in Vietnam. I'm wondering, for instance, if you ever had doubts about your father's role in the military.
Yeah, that's a kind of a touching question. I had doubts for quite some time. But, you know, it's hard. I even had doubts, you know, with my sister, who's my very close friend. And she was working with, you know, the American CIA at the time. And my father is, again, very close and very high-ranking official in the government. But it was very difficult to really talk about it because if I talked about how I really felt about the war, my father would say that I'm a leftist, right? I'm pro-communist. And, you know, it was very hard. In Vietnam, many times, especially during the war, it was either black or white. Nothing is in between. And so we certainly have differences, even though they were not expressed.
Have they ever been expressed, or would you still not talk about it with your family?
You know, they've never been expressed. And every time I bring it up, my father gets really quiet about it. And I'm saying, you know, it's been 20 years. He's been through a lot. So why even talk about it? Why even bring it up? For what purpose? So I think that we'd like to forget about what happened in Vietnam.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
Mai Pham is the owner and chef of the Lemongrass Restaurant and Cafes in Sacramento. Her new book is called The Best of Vietnamese and Thai Cooking. Coming up, a review of the new CD by Hootie and the Blowfish. This is Fresh Air. As over 9 million record buyers know, no one in Hootie and the Blowfish is named Hootie. The band's major label debut, Cracked Rear View, was the biggest rock success story of the past year and was followed by the year's biggest backlash, as many criticized the group's music as bland. Now Hootie and the Blowfish are back with a new release called Fairweather Johnson. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
The signature pop music sound of the moment is one of artful anguish, of romantic agony. You can hear it in the angry squawk of Alanis Morissette and in the pained bleat of Darius Rucker, lead singer for Hootie and the Blowfish. Between them, Alanis and Hootie are at once the most popular and the most disliked acts in rock. That's because the very quality that makes them popular, the inescapable catchiness of their songs, the sincerity of their voices, also makes them the object of hipper-than-thou derision. I think a lot of the hostility has less to do with the music than with its sheer pervasiveness. I praised Alanis Morissette's album here last year when it first came out, but after hearing its slew of angry hit singles for the 700th time on the radio, I was sick of Morissette's skill. The same became true of Hootie's low-key charm. But I think this sort of reaction ought to be resisted, and right now, its new tunes are still fresh in my ears, and Hootie and the Blowfish's Fairweather Johnson sounds very nice to me. One of the curious things about Darius Rucker's voice is its narcotic effect. I don't mean that it puts you to sleep so much as its reedy croon lulls you into not noticing the words he actually pronounces quite clearly. One result of this is that many people miss just how dark and despairing the lyrics of this former frat boy party band really are. Fairweather Johnson is filled with song after song about betraying lovers, about living a solitary, lonely life. The guitars may offer strumming comfort, the melodies may have a reassuring smoothness, but throughout, Darius Rucker prevails upon us to let him moan and groan in a mannerly way, even when he says, as he does in the chorus of this song, "Let me scream, let me scream, let me scream."
Take your heart, take your mind, and escape.
Arriving in the literal wake of the best alternative rock band, Nirvana, Hootie and the Blowfish offered its own alternative. Pain articulated calmly, carefully, precisely. I don't think Hootie and the Blowfish are the bland enemies of revolution its detractors claim the group is. Well-crafted, pretty self-pity will always have its place in what remains of the adolescent wing of rock and roll. And in that area, Hootie and the Blowfish serve a huge constituency well.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Fairweather Johnson by Hootie and the Blowfish. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Cherry Gross.
Could we do it again? If we asked how I felt, and I didn't say this time. You try to scare me with them thoughts. That mean not a thing.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Dow Jones Business News and Information Services, featuring Dow Jones News Retrieval, an online service where business finds answers. This is NPR, National Public Radio.